the patient becomes translationally. And we will continue our strategy of the previous lecture.
Namely, the strategy was, just to remind you, we use the physical laws of matter to determine the equation of space. For example, for pressureless gas, for dust, or for a gas of radiation, we can find out what the relationship between pressure and energy density is. This is physics that we can do in the lab, not a problem. Then, see, a gas of dust or a gas of radiation can really be produced in the lab without problems. Now, let us introduce the terminology that I've already used in a sloppy way, and let's start just make it precise. In the periods of time in the universe in which the equation of state, to a good approximation, was stayed the same, meaning that W stayed the same, are called cosmic epochs. So for example, at the moment, we live in a cosmic epoch, which is, well, actually, that's not quite true what I wanted to say. It used to be considered true up a few years ago. So let's say 6 billion years ago, the universe was in a period that was very well described as dominated, where the energy momentum tensor was dominated by a gas of galaxies, which behaved just like pressureless dust. And that period lasted for several billion years. And during that period, W was always the same. Namely, it was zero. It was pressureless after all. Nowadays, the cosmological constant has started to come to the foreground because matter has been diluted away. And so now we're in a transitional period in between epochs. We come out of the epoch of dust domination, and we are entering the epoch of dark energy domination. So after another few billion years, apparently, the energy momentum in galaxies and dark matter will be small compared to the energy in the cosmological constant. And then we can describe the equation of state of the universe as P equal to minus rho. That's the case of the dark energy domination. And you will say that this epoch is the dark energy dominated epoch. And it probably, as far as we can tell now, will never have an end. Because once the cosmological constant dominates, well, that's it. Then it will only further dilute the contribution from matter and radiation. Now, previously, before matter domination, there was also a period in which radiation dominated because it was so hot. And in this case, the W parameter was a third. And that period lasted for 100,000 years, maybe 200,000 or 300,000 years. Okay, the point is, the definition is that in any period in the universe in which W was, for a while at least, relatively constant, we would call an epoch, a cosmic epoch. Right, so, if we assume, if we consider a particular epoch, we are looking at a particular W, a particular equation of state parameter. Then we can use this equation of state, this relationship between P and rho, which is a fixed proportionality within an epoch, during an epoch. We use this proportionality between P and rho within the fixed, during that fixed epoch, to solve this equation P that we proved at the end of the last lecture. And we obtain then a rho of A. Remember, rho of A is what we are after, because once we have that, we can plug it into the Friedmann equation and then solve for A itself. Namely, strategy is, in an epoch, T is equal to W rho. We plug that into here. T is W rho. So what we have to solve is d by dA of that equal to minus 3 whole squared and then W rho. This differential equation can be solved in full generality, no matter what W is, as long as W is constant. So we cannot, at least not easily, solve this equation if W is a function of time, as it is, for example, now, because we are in this transition period between method domination and dark energy constant domination. Dark energy is another word for cosmological constant. So we're in this transition period where W is changing its value. It's changing its value from dark domination, which is zero, to lambda domination, which is minus 1. We are somewhere around minus 0.5. So when you're looking at an epoch in which W is, during which W is fairly constant, then we can actually solve this differential equation by the usual tricks of solving ordinary differential equations. And this is the solution. It's not hard to see that. Then what do we get? I already showed you three special cases of the solution at the end of the last lecture. And this is just the general solution for whatever W is. If W is the one for the matter-dominated epoch, W is equal to zero, I mean for the pressureless dust, then the energy density scales like a fixed prefactor times 1 over the third power of A, which is to say it decays proportionally to the inverse of the volume. And then we said that in a radiation-dominated epoch, where W is 1/3, we have a quicker dilution of the energy density, namely proportional to 1 over the volume times 1 over the scale factor. 1 over the volume expresses the dilution, 1 over the scale factor expresses the stretching of the wavelength, the vector. And in the case of dark energy domination, this is to say when cosmological constant dominates, we have that the energy density is going like A to the power of zero. It is constant after all, dark energy domination. But what we can read off from this general solution here as well is that W equal minus 1 is a threshold case. If W is equal to minus 1, then this thing is zero, and we have A to the power of zero, which is to say that the energy density is constant. This is the case of dark energy domination. W is equal to minus 1 makes the exponent zero. This is the constant. Now imagine what would happen if W was smaller than minus 1. That would change the character of the whole thing completely. Okay? If W was smaller than minus 1, then what we would have here is some negative number here, and therefore some positive exponent for the A. That would be amazing. It would mean that the energy density actually increases as the size of the, as the universe increases. So we get anti-dilution. The more the universe expands, the more the energy blows up, the energy density goes up. Well, it depends. I mean, we are not, I mean, you see, the case W equal to minus 1 is the case without any matter. It depends on what the underlying model is. What sort of material would have a W smaller than minus 1? We don't know of any physical fields that would have that property. Remember that if you just take, for example, a scalar field with a potential, and you calculate its energy momentum tensor, then we notice that when the kinetic energy is relatively small and the scalar field is relatively constant in space, and the potential is therefore the dominant term in the energy momentum tensor, then the potential will play a role just like the cosmological constant, which is to say that a scalar field that is not changing fast in space or in time, but is exposed to a large potential, a scalar field with a large V of phi, has a relationship between energy density and pressure, which is close to being minus one, but it's still a little bit larger than minus one, because there is going to be kinetic energy and there's going to be some space length that we need. So a scalar field gets as close to minus one if it's dominated by its potential and not by its kinetic term, but it never gets us below minus one. So we don't know how that would come about, a case where the energy density would increase with the scale. But in principle, general relativity allows for that. And after all, this is something that could be measured. And at the moment, we are in this transitional period between a matter-dominated period and a dark energy-dominated period. We believe this is what the expectation values of our measurements are telling us. But the standard deviations are still pretty big. And in principle, it is not experimentally excluded that what we are heading for is a case of W smaller than minus one. Not that we would have any reason to believe that this comes up, because it would entail the existence of rather strange kinds of matter that, I mean, it's certainly none of the kinds of matter that we have now can produce a W smaller than minus one. But experimentally, it's not ruled out. But as we will see later on, the case W smaller minus one is really a case that we should worry about if we are planning to live on for several billion years, because it would mean that we would be ripped apart in a finite amount of time. You see, if the universe is dark energy dominated by cosmological constant, then the universe will exponentially expand. But the expansion will go on forever. So if humanity lives on forever, it will just get a lonely place, because everything gets ripped apart in the sense that distances increase. And after a while, we won't see our neighboring galaxy. It will look as if we have the only galaxy in the universe, because everything else is so far away. but that's all. And in principle, one could go on forever, except that stars will burn out and so on. But if W were smaller than minus one, as you will see this very soon, we are not that lucky, because the universe would get an infinite scale factor. The scale factor would diverge towards infinity at a finite time in the future. That means a complete rip apart of everything. All distances would go to infinity in a finite amount of time. Anyway, let's get there. So we said we get the rho of A. That's what this whole exercise was about. We get the rho of A. These are the special cases we're interested in. This is the general case. And we can plug this rho of A now into the Friedmann equation. And the Friedmann equation then, as promised, as advertised, becomes an equation that is only a function, a differential equation for A only. So this is the Friedmann equation. And on the right hand side, it has rho. But we can express now rho as a function of A, namely using this, rho as a function of A. Therefore, we obtain an ordinary differential equation for A only, a nonlinear one, so that makes it hard, but still, it's a differential equation that involves only A and its first derivative, and nothing else. And it can be solved. It can be solved, and for k equal to zero, this is the solution. I'll spare you the details of this, but if you wish, you can just plug that into the differential equation up there and see that it's the right. So for k equal to zero, for example, assuming now that, you see, remember that the Freeman equation depends on k. So for k equal to 0, which is to say we assume that space-time is spatially completely flat, in that case, the scale factor behaves like this, where w here is our equation of state parameter. Now, remember that A occurs, that A dot is squared in the Friedman equation. And this means that if A of t is a solution to the Friedman equation, then A of minus t is also a solution. Okay? Because A dot will just change by a sign, but A dot occurs only in a squared form of the differential equation. Therefore, for every expansion describing solution, you will also have a contraction describing solution. They always go hand in hand, the whole thing is time reversal symmetric. That's why we have a plus and a minus sign. There's one special case that is not quite covered by this, which is the case where w is equal to minus 1. You see, this is a power law, always a power of t, and that power increases as w approaches minus 1, because then this gets closer and closer to 0, that gets closer and closer to infinity, and that's the power of it, t to the power of that. What's happening here is that in order to solve this differential equation, we have to treat the case w equal to minus 1 as a special case. And in that special case, and only in that special case, the solution is not of that form, but instead of the solution being a power of t, the solution is exponential. No, it's just like when you integrate 1 over t to the power of a, 1 over t to the power of alpha, let's say. Then you can do that for alpha. But watch out, if alpha is 1, I mean, if you have 1 over t and want to integrate that, and you get the logarithm, suddenly things are different. Okay, so whenever you want to integrate something like x to the power of alpha, you want to integrate this thing, dx, then you can do it for all alpha straightforwardly, but if alpha is minus 1, you get the logarithm, special case. And it's exactly the situation that happened here. So I gave you here the general case for w not equal to minus 1. We know what it is for w equal to minus 1, it's just exponential. And for w not equal to minus 1, it's a polynomial of, you know, correspondingly high degree. So here is here are the most important cases for comparison. In a matter-dominated epoch, so it's a dust, a pressureless dust, w is equal to 0, pressure is 0, and the value of the exponent up there is 2/3, if w is equal to 0, 2/3 in the exponent. So what we have is that the size of scale factor scales like t to the power of 2/3. So the distance between, if you look at two particular galaxies, then their distance as a function of time behaves like t to the power of 2/3. So in a matter-dominated universe, this is the distance between two galaxies as a function of time curve. If the universe is radiation-dominated, then the distance between two co-moving things like galaxies just goes like the square root, like that, which is not that much different. Now, when we approach, as we apparently do now, when we approach an epoch of dark energy domination, of cosmological constant domination, then W is minus 1 plus a little bit. So when we are getting closer to W equal minus 1, when the cosmological constant starts to become the dominant piece in the energy momentum center, namely because matter and radiation dilute away, then we can write the equation of state parameter as minus 1 plus a little bit. And this little bit, traditionally, is written as 2 over 3 R, where R simply parameterizes how far we are still away from omega equal minus 1. How far we are still away from the situation with the dark energy completely dominates. Well, if we parameterize the equation of state parameter in this way, then the and now you will see why we choose to write the parameter, the deviation from minus 1 parameter as 2 over 3 R. When you do that, then, you know, just this 2 over 3 gets canceled away. And 1 plus W, right, that's just this little difference here. Then we obtain that the universe expands at the rate of P to the power of R. So as we get closer and closer to W equal minus 1, R gets bigger and bigger. You see, this term gets smaller and smaller as we get closer to cosmological constant domination. This term gets smaller and smaller, meaning that R gets bigger and bigger, meaning that P to the power of R gets steeper and steeper. So this is the type of expansion that we have now. And it used to be thought until recently that it would look like that. But it does look like this. This is exactly, pretty much exactly those curves are what you see when you look at those brightness versus redshift plots of supernovae. The ones that indicate, the ones that first showed that apparently we are now starting to be cosmological constant dominant. Right, and then if in the idealized case where everything is totally dark energy dominated and W is equal to minus 1, then as I said, it's a special case and the solution to the differential equation is an exponential. And that is easy to check, that it is solved by that. So in other words, in the case of complete domination by the cosmological constant, W equal minus 1, the universe expands, in fact, faster than any polynomial, namely exponential. But there is a possibility for expansion faster than exponential. Namely, in a super expanding epoch, W would be minus 1. It would be smaller than minus 1. As I said, it's not obvious that this is realistic, but let's just play it through. If W was smaller than minus 1, then this would be the expansion law, which is to say that it would go like P to the power of minus some small number. You know, the small number indicates how far away we are, how far below we are minus 1, which is a curve which looks like this. It has a pole. It's like 1 over x. And, I mean, this is the 0 here. Don't think that the 0 time coordinate is here. The 0 time coordinate is starting over here. So that would be the case where the scale factor increases, but actually diverges, goes to infinity at a finite amount of time, at the point of time which, in our choice of time coordinate, is the time t equals 0. So please don't be confused. The time in the future when everything would be ripped apart to infinite height is the time t equals 0 in this choice of coordinates. Well, that would be good. Now, a key definition, any epoch in which the second derivative of the scale factor is larger than 0, and that includes the power law epoch, where we are close to, but still above minus 1 in the equation of state parameter, where this goes just like some power. See, the second derivative is positive. You know, it's accelerating, curving upward. It includes the total energy domination, total regular magnetic domination case, and it includes the big rip case of super expanding period. All those cases in which A double dot is larger than zero, in which we have acceleration, is called an inflationary period. And so I invite you to check that this is a one-to-one corresponding to requiring that W is smaller than minus one third. Not half, really not half. Check the equation we had above. So notice that in order to have inflation, we don't have to have the W is equal to minus one. W just has to be smaller than minus one third, and we are close enough to have accelerated positive. Okay. So here's the most likely timeline. The universe started out in the Planck era, where we really don't know much, which lasted about 10 to the minus 43 seconds. 10 to the minus 43 seconds multiplied with the speed of light gives us the Planck length. And it's just the boundary of our knowledge. We don't really know what happened in that period. But then the idea is that we had a period of inflation, and now you know what that means, strictly speaking. It means a period of W smaller than minus one third, a period in which we had acceleration, and that would have been because dark energy dominates. But dark energy doesn't have to be because of a cosmological constant. As we saw earlier in this course, you can get pretty close to W minus one, equal minus one, just using a scalar field. A scalar field's energy momentum tensor will look just like the energy momentum tensor contribution that comes from the cosmological constant if the scalar field has a potential V of phi very large compared to its kinetic part. So this is what is assumed to have happened there, but only for a short amount of time, until about 10 to the minus 32 seconds at the beginning. So that is not just a fraction of a second, this is a tiny fraction of a second, 10 to the minus 32 seconds. And then it is believed that there was a period of radiation domination after the end of inflation. I will say, of course, much more about inflation and on all of those things, it's just a rough overview. And then there was, then assume that there was a period of radiation domination, which lasted from the end of inflation. At the end of inflation, we had a universe that was very, very hot and full of radiation. And that expanded and cooled in the process. And it was always radiation dominated because it was hot enough for that, until about 10 to the 13 seconds after the Big Bang. And 10 to the 13 seconds is about 100,000 years. After about 100,000 years, the universe would have cooled down to a temperature on the order of 1,000 Kelvin. At 1,000 Kelvin, hydrogen gases form. At higher than on the order of 1,000 Kelvin, protons and electrons won't hold together. They don't hold together. But as soon as you have a temperature lower than that, protons and electrons combine, and you have a gas. Above that, above the temperature, you have a plasma, because everything is ionized. Below the temperature, you have a gas. Now, that makes a huge difference, because while you still have a plasma, radiation dominates the whole picture. But as soon as you have a neutral atoms forming, that is after about 100,000 years, you have those neutral hydrogen atoms forming. Well, the neutral hydrogen atoms are pretty much transparent. So now the radiation decouples from the matter. The radiation does its own thing, and matter does its own thing. But remember that radiation dilutes faster than matter. So now it's just a matter of time until matter wins over radiation, because radiation the energy density due to radiation will go down like scale factor to the fourth power. That the energy density of of matter will go down only scale factor to the third power. So eventually, we get matter domination. Right, and that goes on for about 10 to the 19 seconds. You realize, of course, that this is a logarithmic scale here. 10 to 19 seconds, which is about today, and roughly today, plus minus a few billion years. you don't get to say that very often, right? So roughly around today, plus minus a few billion years, dark energy is starting to dominate simply because it doesn't dilute as fast as matter does. Okay. Now, something I wanted to point out is this. You may wonder, how speculative is it as we go back into this? I mean, obviously we don't know about the Planck era, but how risky is it to make statements about what happened at 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the Big Bang, for example? How risky is that? I mean, how on earth do we know what's happening there? Now, the thing is, we know pretty well what's happened there. And that's because all of that physics can be tested in the lab. All of the physics here was right up to 10 to the minus 11 seconds. And that's because at that time, the universe was still radiation dominated. There were no atoms. Everything was ionized. It was a plasma. And the temperatures were, of course, hellishly hot, which is to say that the collisions between the photons, the electrons, the quarks, and whatnot were very, very highly energetic. But you can calculate how energetic they were. Of course, it was gazillions of Kelvin hot. But let's translate that, the temperature, into the collision energy. What was the energy of particle collisions 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the Big Bang? Well, it was about 1 TeV, 1 tera electron volt, which is about this much. And the thing is, you can do that. A Fermilab or LHC at CERN, they can easily do a TeV, which is to say that we can recreate the collision that happened at that time. Not earlier, because they would have been high energetic than what we can do, but we can go this far back in time, which is to say that we can probe the physics all the way back to that, which in particular means that the physics of, let's say, 1 second after the Big Bang, and it doesn't sound like, which already sounds outrageous, right? But the physics of 1 second after the Big Bang is much cooler physics, much colder physics, and that's absolutely safe. The physics of 1 second after the Big Bang is the physics of nuclear physics. It's where you have that nuclei form, where quarks condense into neutrons and protons. And that is easy to do in the lab, very easy. We have accelerators a billion times more energy available than is needed for nuclear reactions. You see, nuclear reactions happen on the mega-electron volt scale. And then a factor of 1,000 is giga-electron volt. Another factor of 1,000 is tera-electron volt. So really, this is a million times more energy than typical energies of nuclear reactors. Okay, so I think that this is just to say that we can be pretty confident that we know the physics right up to this scale. I mean, even the regular physics, not just the gravitational physics. Okay, now, why on earth would one assume that there is this inflationary period? Well, it was initially proposed, this inflationary period, by Robert Brout and by François Englert and some others, but I think Brout and Englert were the first to do that. They got also a prize for this, but they are not recognized for it. That's why I'm putting it on the record. the paper is out there, of course. The idea is we have to solve the so-called flatness problem. And the solution came in 1979, when Robert Brout wrote that paper. Let us reconsider the experimental finding that k is about zero, or more precisely, that space-time seems to be spatially pretty much flat. Well, we rewrite the Friedmann equation, which contains k, and we absorb lambda now in rho, just so that we don't have to keep track of it, right? So we just speak of energy and pressure, and the energy may have a component that arises from cosmological constant or that arises from radiation or whatnot. We don't distinguish it anymore. We just consider lambda to be part of rho and heat. Okay, so then we have that the Friedmann equation can be written like this, where rho total now is the energy density of matter plus the vector. All right, so this is the Friedman equation, and notice that I replace A dot over A by the Hubble parameter H of T. It's just a definition, it's not a proposition. A dot over A is called H, the Hubble parameter. Hubble didn't see this number evolve over time, so he called it, so it was, at the time it was called the Hubble constant. But now, of course, you know it evolves over time, A dot over A, so it's called the Hubble parameter. Okay, so that's the Friedman equation. And the experimental observation that K is pretty close to zero, or essentially zero, that there is no spatial curvature to speak of, means that this term is absent. This is to say that the experimental observations tell us that H of T squared is equal to this, which is a very good approximation. Okay? So this is what experiments tell us. It means that this is an equation that's pretty, well, not necessarily exact, but very close to being fulfilled. Therefore, we say that the energy density that that makes this equation hold without this term is called the critical energy density. Okay? So if K is equal to zero, or if K is to be equal to zero, then this energy density has to match that Hubble parameter. And you see, this is something that experimentally to be verified. This is A dot over A, can be measured. And this is the energy density, which also can be measured. So the claim is that experimentally, we find that the energy density is matching, which is to say this is the critical energy density. If the energy density had come out experimentally to be very different, then we could conclude that K is plus 1 or minus 1, or is positive or is negative. But the fact that there is no spatial curvature, apparently, or nearly no spatial curvature, means that the energy density is pretty much the critical energy density, which means that this term is absent. Yes, 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 it's very close to it. So we know that this is the case today. I mean, by today, I mean plus minus, you know, a billion years. Now, at any given time, you see, K is either zero or not, but it's not changing. K is a constant in this system. Okay, so that means that for K to be equal to zero, this equation here must match, I mean, this term must match that term, not just at one point in time, but at all times. Because at all times, this term is absent. If it's absent at one point in time, it's absent at all times, because K is the fixed constant. So what does that mean? It means that we have that the energy density, the critical energy density for having K equal to zero, is locked into matching H squared. Let us calculate that locking. So at any given time, the critical energy density is that energy, right? So if the energy density of the universe takes that value, then K is equal to zero. But that must be true at all times. So how close to critical are we now? And how close were we in the past? And how close will we be in the future? The question is this. If, let's say, at some point in time, the energy density is close to critical, but not quite exactly the critical energy, then wait a few billion years. What is the energy density then? Is it now closer or further away from the critical energy density? And amazingly, it's going to be much further away. Let's see how that happens. Just make a definition. Omega, which has nothing to do with the omegas that we defined previously, omega of t is the total energy density, omega of t, it's the total energy density that we actually measure in the universe, divided by the critical energy density that the universe should have if it was spatially flat, if k is equal to 0. Okay? This is the actual energy density at time t divided by the critical energy density that would ensure k is equal to 0. So at the moment, we are pretty close to 1. The actual energy density is pretty close to the critical energy density that would lead to k equal to 0. So we can solve that and say that the actual energy density is this factor here, which is close to 1 at present, multiplied with that. Okay, because this is the critical energy density. Okay, just solve that equation. So now let us look how this thing is evolving in time. Omega of t is expressing how close we are to critical energy density. How does that evolve in time, this omega of t? Now it's close to 1. How close was it to 1 in the past? So the Friedmann equation can now be expressed in terms of this omega. Using this, we can replace the actual energy density in the Friedmann equation by this business here to get that. We have just taken the Friedmann equation, replaced rho by omega h squared. That's just it. You see, the Friedmann equation is this plus that, and then here on the right hand side you have the rho. Yeah, noisy. Okay, so should I try to make myself louder?
Yeah.
That's not right. Well, I don't know whether it gets any louder. Okay, so the Friedmann equation is this equation in terms of omega. But now let's solve this Friedmann equation for omega, and we get that. We get that the deviation, remember, this is just the Friedmann equation. We get that the deviation from omega equal 1 is given by that. Obviously, for consistency, we must have that if k equal to 0, then the deviation from 1 is 0. At all times, consistent, that's fine. But what are the chances that k is equal to 0? Can't forget about it, that's not going to happen. The most we can be is very, very, very close to 0, which means that omega of t is very close to 1. So this is a very small number here. And then we see that, hey, that's time dependent. How far we are from 1 depends on time. If we are not exactly at 1, if the energy density is not exactly 1, it's not exactly the critical energy density, which is to say that if space-time is not exactly spatially flat, if it has a little bit of positive or negative curvature, well, then the deviation from flatness, the deviation from criticality, is dependent on time. And if a dot, and depending on how a dot is evolving, that deviation is going to increase or decrease. And as you will see, generically, it's going to increase and increase dramatically. That is an important problem here. You see, we are in a matter-dominated epoch now. So a goes like t to the power of 2/3, which means that a dot goes like t to the power of minus 1/3. Which is to say that if you plug it into here, that the deviation from criticality, the deviation from flatness, as a function of time, goes like k t to the power of 2/3. Okay, so minus 1/3, 1/3. That's how that comes about. So that means that as time increases, our deviation from flatness increases. Which may not sound like a big problem if we look into the future, but look into the past. It means that we must have been much closer to criticality. The universe must have been much closer to being perfectly flat in the past for it to be still pretty flat today. For example, the ratio between the closeness to criticality now and the closeness to criticality later or earlier is given by the ratio of the times to the power of 2/3. So given, for example, that nowadays the difference, the distance from criticality is of order 1, so the energy density in the universe is perhaps like 10-20% off from the critical energy density. I mean, you can't measure it so precisely, but we may be off by like 10-20% or so. Definitely not more than order 1. It means that earlier, see, if this is like 0.5 or whatnot, 0.2, if this is 0.2, then much earlier at a time, like, you know, if you go a millionth of T1, so now we are a billion years, and we are not, the universe is 10 billion years old. So if you divide by a million, that would give us 10,000 years. So after 10,000 years after the Big Bang, we would have had to be much closer to the to criticality, namely this distance here would have to be of order 10 to the minus 4. That's pretty fine-tuned, right? We would have to be so close. The energy density could deviate only by, you know, a factor of 1.0001. But that's nothing. I mean, why stop going back only to 10,000 years after the Big Bang? Let's go back to, for example, t equal to 10 to the minus 11 seconds. This is the critical time where the energy of collisions was 1 TeV. This is what we can still do in the lab. This is as far back as we can trust our knowledge of physics. So if we go back to when the universe was 10 to the minus 11 seconds old, so we have to go back by a factor of 10 to the minus 30. We have to divide the current time by 10 to the minus 30 to go there as far back. Well, then, in order for the universe to be flat today, up to a deviation of order 1, it would have to have been flat at the time with a precision of 10 to the minus 24 in order to still be so precisely flat today. Eduardo?
Do the assumptions of homogeneity that led to these equations hold for these times?
Well, you're right. In principle, one should check the stability of these predictions with respect to perturbations of the assumptions. Could be that perturbations would grow and overwhelm those estimates. Now, I haven't done these calculations myself, but you can do that, and in fact, you can use the same calculations that are being, the same technology that's being used to calculate. I think it's safe, and for the following reason. And you will see later today, there is a whole machinery for perturbing such a space-time, and you can follow the evolution of such perturbations, and you can see how fast they would grow, and so you can check the stability of those statements. I mean, in short, the answer is, yes, it is stable, but a longer answer would be why it is stable. And and I'll show you roughly, at least today, how you can perturb those space-time and then follow perturbation. Okay, so the conclusion here is that flatness is not stable. If the universe is a little bit off from being flat early on, then it shouldn't be flat at all today. It should be very strongly curved, either positively or negatively. So that means that our observation of the universe is pretty close to flatness today. And that implies that the universe must have started out flat with tremendous precision. So what is the solution to the fine-tuning problem? Well, Broad, Englert, and Starobinsky, Linda, and others, but Broad and Englert first, said, well, let's see. Isn't there a possibility for an epoch in the universe in which this thing here, the deviation from criticality, the deviation from flatness, is actually getting smaller? What we just said is that in the case of matter domination, and the same could be said for radiation domination, the deviation from flatness increases over time, and quite dramatically so. And so they said,
Well, maybe early on in the universe, there was a period in which this deviation was driven to very, very, very close to zero. Maybe there was a period in which the universe was driven towards flatness dynamically, and so that it achieved a tremendous amount of flatness, enough flatness so that the radiation and matter-dominated epochs that came later couldn't undo that much of flatness fast enough, so that we still have an enormous amount of flatness left over. So they were wondering, isn't there a possibility for this thing to shrink over time, for space to become flatter over time rather than more curved? Well, of course, that can happen. It can happen if and only if A dot squared actually increases with time. Right? If A dot squared increases with time, then this thing decreases with time and space becomes flatter. Now, in a radiation-dominated universe or matter-dominated universe, A dot, the expansion rate, is slowing down. Right? I mean, in matter-dominated universe, the galaxies are moving apart from another, but slower and slower and slower. The expansion is slowing down. A dot is slowing down, which means that this, the denominator becomes smaller, the whole thing becomes bigger, and that is what led us to this instability. But what Broden and Nair pointed out is that if you are in an epoch of the universe, or if there was early on an epoch in the universe in which A dot was increasing over time, then that would have driven the universe towards that. But remember, that was our definition of inflation. A double dot larger zero is the definition for inflation. And that happens if and only if W is smaller than minus one third. It's also called the inflationary attractor. Now, what are the experimental constraints on this? Well, in order to account for the degree of flatness that we observe today, which is inferred by various means, for example, the cosmic microwave background, a period of near exponential inflation should have expanded the universe by a factor of at least e to the power 60. This is as much inflation that we need early on, so that the universe was driven to sufficient flatness that the remnant flatness that we see now after epochs of radiation and matter domination is still as good as we see it now. So in other words, if the radiation and matter dominated epochs in the universe were preceded by an inflationary period that expanded the scale factor by about e to the power 60 or 10 to the power 20, then the universe was driven so flat that it still looks flat today, at least to order one.
Is it by experiments or is it a
mathematics? No, by experiments.
But the mathematics that we did above was independent of the experiments.
Yes, mathematically we can account for all cases. We can account for positive, negative, or vanishing curvature. So the conjecture of an early inflationary epoch was quite successful. And one of the things it was successful in explaining this flatness problem, but it's also explaining several other problems at the same time. For example, the absence of exotic high mass particles. You see, when the universe was initially very, very hot, it then cooled down, and in principle, there's a possibility that so-called defect formed when that happened. For that, you need to know, and some of you or most of you may not have enough background in quantum field theory, but quantum field theories can undergo phase transition. It's just like a crystal, for example. A crystal is a product of a condensation process, and the opposite would be the melting and evaporation of a crystal. Now, if you take, for example, molten iron, and you cool it down, then at some point it will get solid and form a regular crystal. However, that crystal will have irregularities in it, basically because the orientation of the newly formed crystal in one region may not have had enough time to communicate with the newly formed orientation of some other crystal piece that formed over there so that they were aligned. If the cool down is very, very slow, then they can communicate in time, and the whole thing in principle could end up in, as a completely regular crystal. But if you cool things down very quickly, then you can have defects. You can have that the orientations don't quite match, and well, then you get another kind of material. I mean, the material properties will be different because you have defects in there. With some crystals, you can even push and pull on them, and then the defects will move. They will move in the crystal. In practice, for example, samurai swords are produced using this technology. If you take iron and cool it down on purpose, very, very quickly, so you make it white hot, and then you put it into cold water, then it will cool down very quickly, so a lot of crystal defects will form in the crystal, and they give you strength. See, it can't bend as much. The crystals will be in the way. The defects will be in the way. And so there's a whole, I'm no expert in this, but I think there's a whole art and science behind making a good sword, because you want the flexibility, of course, for the bulk of the sword, but you also want that the sharp part of it is as hard as possible. So it has to be very hard, at the expense, perhaps, of being a little bit brittle. But you make up for the brittleness by making the bulk of the sword having less defect. Anyway, in with quantum field theories, it's similar. You can have the particles at very high energies are just like a gas, but then at lower energies, you have that the quantum field theory itself, and you shouldn't think of it as the particles, but the quantum field theory itself will undergo a phase transition. And In effect, particles will combine to form new particles, a new kind of particles that wouldn't be seen at higher temperatures. And there again, if the cool down is fast enough, you get topological defects, just like defects in a quickly forming crystal. And in the case of quantum field theory, they would be observable objects, such as cosmic strings or, any monopole, things like that. And in principle, it is expected that such particles were produced early on in the universe, and at sufficiently high energies, like at the Planck scale, there would have been enough energy to create all sorts of things, and in principle there could have been a lot of those defects. And none of those have been seen in experiment. So how come there aren't? Now, if there was a period of inflation, then all particles that existed before the period of inflation would have been completely diluted away, because the universe expanded by a factor of e to the 60. So that such particles may be around, but so rare that we don't observe them. On the other hand, this gives us a new problem to solve, namely, where do particles come from? If all particles that were there before the period of inflation, that might have been there before the period of inflation, have been diluted away, just by because the universe expanded by a factor of 10 to the 20, so that everything diluted away by a factor of 1 over 10 to the 60, right? Because the volume, if you look at the volume density. Yep.
But what is the time life of these huge defects?
The bigger they could live forever, actually.
Forever?
Yeah, or if you have any monopole, there never be case in principle. But there is a solution to this problem too within inflationary theory. Namely, remember that in the inflationary epoch might be caused by a scalar field. After all, we don't want the cosmological constant to be dominant early on in the universe, because it would have been dominant up until today. The universe would be expanding at a tremendous rate, would have been expanding at an exponential rate always, and that gives no time for galaxies to form and so on. So there couldn't have been a dominant cosmological constant at the beginning of the universe, but instead there should have been a fake one. There should have been one mimicked by a scalar field, for example, which, if the kinetic terms are small, and that is called slow roll, basically moving small, because this is the kinetic term, then the contribution of the scalar field to the energy density is the potential. The contribution of the scalar field to the pressure is minus the potential. Therefore, the relationship between energy density and pressure is that of a factor of minus one. So W is close to minus one. So the idea is that there was that there is a field in the universe, a so-called inflaton field, a scalar field with a suitable potential that started out at an elevated value of the potential, such that for a while it mimicked the cosmological constant. And we were at W close to minus one, so that the universe expanded by at least a factor of e to the 60, and that would have made it flat enough. That would have diluted away all those particles that could have been produced but have not been observed yet. And then this potential phi also could explain where the particles are coming from that we are made of. Namely, after the period of inflation, namely when the field phi evolved to the minimum of the potential V, then all the energy that was in the potential V would have gone into something, namely into the production of all sorts of particles. And that means that after the period of inflation ended, the energy that used to be in V of phi turns into the energy in particles. So after inflation ended, you would have a universe that's extremely hot and full of particles. This is called reheating, because the universe might have been hot before the period of inflation started. And this is how it gets hot again, after inflation, when all the energy that used to be in the V is now in particles. The context of an early inflationary period explains more things. In particular, it explains the so-called horizon problem. You see, when you look at the cosmic microwave background in this direction and in that direction, they look just the same. They have the same temperature, up to a precision of 10 to the minus 5. And that is quite amazing, because if you look at a diagram where this is space and that is time, this is us, and we look back at the cosmic microwave background in one direction and in another direction, then we see a different parts of the universe. I mean, this is some, what we see here is the first photons that were, I mean, what is the cosmic microwave background anyway? Remember that the hydrogen plasma, when it cooled down to below of the order of 1,000 Kelvin, turned into hydrogen gas, which means that it suddenly consisted of neutral atoms instead of protons and electrons, which are ions, and therefore reactive light. So as soon as the temperature was cold enough, the universe was filled with neutral hydrogen gas, which is transparent. And so all the heat radiation that was present at that time, at the time of the phase transition, suddenly found itself able to travel freely, because it just was not interacting anymore with the protons and the electrons, because the protons and electrons were happy with just orbiting another and forming neutral particles. So the universe suddenly became transparent. All the heat radiation that was there started flowing freely, and we still see that heat radiation. It's been redshifted now by a factor of 1,000 or so, because the universe has expanded by a factor of 1,000 or so since that happened, 100,000 years after the Big Bang. But we can still see it. So instead of the cosmic microwave background radiation being thousands of kelvins hot, which is what it was when the phase transition happened from the hydrogen plasma to the hydrogen gas, it's now only a few kelvin hot because of the redshift. Anyway, so when we look at this, what we see is, when we look at the cosmic microwave background in this direction, we see the light that was emanating from a plasma over there in this direction. And if we look at there, we see light emanating from a plasma in that direction. Now, the thing is that those two patches of plasma are very far away. This one is, you know, has been, the light from that patch has been traveling 13.7 billion years this direction, and that one 13.7 billion years in this direction, which means in particular that those two patches of plasma were at the time causally disconnected. Because they lived, you see, at the time that this patch of plasma emitted the photons that we see now, emitted the cosmic microwave effect ground radiation that we see now, the universe was only 100,000 years old. So since those two patches are dozens of billions of light years apart, and where dozens of billions of light years apart, actually millions of light years apart, because there's a factor of thousands of universe expanding by then. Since they were millions of light years apart at the time, but the universe was only 100,000 years old, they could never have communicated. So they could not have equilibrated. So why would they have the same temperature? Now, that problem is also solved by a period of inflation, because the period of inflation takes a patch of the universe, which is very small, or I mean, it just takes any little patch of the universe and blows it up by a factor of 10 to the 20 at least, which means that it homogenizes things at a very, very large scale. And then if that homogeneous region then undergoes phase transitions and so on, it's no wonder that they are doing exactly the same, because they were causally connected. Basically, the exponentially fast expansion of space-time in that period here between the Big Bang and the CMB was bending in those light cones such that they do overlap. And finally, and that is, I suppose, the biggest success of inflationary theory, we have that the conjecture of early inflationary, of an early inflationary epoch, and that is something that came after Broad and Engler, is due to Linde, Mukhanov, and others, is that it also explains the occurrence and precise statistics of the inhomogeneities of the universe. See, inflation seems to do too much of a good job. It says that if the universe started out with wrinkles and, you know, with curvature and all sorts of things, then if it underwent an inflationary period, then it was stretched out to enormous size, such that everything was flat. But then we end up with a universe that is flat and has absolutely no structure in it. You may wonder, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is that really the universe is, of course, full of wrinkles. I mean, there's a galaxy here, and no galaxy over there, and another one over there. There is inhomogeneity. Why would there be inhomogeneity? And what is the statistics of that, of those inhomogeneity? I mean, in principle, we can go out there and we can measure where each galaxy is sitting, as we can see, and then we can do a statistics of their mutual distance. And then we can see how they are distributed. What is the statistics of the random distribution of the galaxy? And we can ask, can we predict that statistics? If we can do that, we can perhaps understand what is the origin of the inhomogeneities of the universe. Why not? Why everything is not just totally a uniform soup, but rather it's clumpy. And the details of the clumpiness. Of course, you can never predict why there's a galaxy over there, but you may be able to predict the statistical distribution of the galaxies. And amazingly, that's been done. That's worked. The idea is that the quantum fluctuations of the scalar field that was first invented to allow us to have an inflationary period, if a scalar, so-called inflaton field, will have quantum fluctuations once you treat it with quantum field theory. And the idea is that those quantum fluctuations provided the seeds for the initial inhomogeneities in the universe. The idea is that inflation first completely flattened everything, but quantum fluctuations of the field seeded the universe again with inhomogeneities, about which then the galaxies condensed and so on, and then the structure formed out of this. Mm. So for that, in principle, the strategy is easy to check. This, the statistics of quantum fluctuations is very well known, because we can measure quantum fluctuations in the lab, and we have the full theory of them. We can predict what the distribution of inhomogeneities in the universe should be if it was caused by the quantum fluctuations of a scalar field. And we can compare that with what we see in nature. And in particular, we can try to predict the fluctuation spectrum in epoxy microspectra. This is a picture that displays the actually measured fluctuations in the temperature of the epoxy microspectra. So this is a map of the inhomogeneity of the universe when it was 100,000 years old. So more precisely, if you go 13.7 billion light years in all directions, then you see the phase transition happening between plasma and gas, which is when the radiation was liberated, and it has been traveling since to us. So you see here a shell of the universe of radius 13.7 billion light years, except that the universe has expanded since, so it's more like dozens of billions of light years. And so this is that shell, and what you see is the inhomogeneities in the universe there. And you can see that, you know, you can calculate the statistics of those fluctuations here. And normally you would do that with Fourier transform, but this is a sphere. It's a sphere of the sky, and the analog of Fourier transform for the sphere is the decomposition into spherical harmonics, the same spherical harmonics that you use to decompose hydrogen atom wavelength. Just a mathematical tool. They replace the Fourier factors of that space. So you can expand this in spherical harmonics, essentially in eigenfunctions to the angular momentum operator. And you can look at the statistics. And this is the predicted statistics, which was first predicted in the early 80s or so. This is what the statistics of those quantum fluctuations should look like if they were caused by, of these temperature fluctuations should look like if they were caused by quantum fluctuations. I'm skipping a lot of things here because really a lot of plasma physics goes into predicting this from the quantum fluctuations. You see, this is not directly the quantum fluctuations. This is how the quantum fluctuations look like after 100,000 years of plasma physics. But keep in mind that plasma physics can be studied in the lab, so we are pretty sure about it. In any case, this is the prediction for the spectrum of the of those temperature fluctuations. Here's the amplitude drawn over the wavelengths, or more precisely, over the angular momentum eigenvalue. Now, the spherical harmonics are labeled by a number L and a number M, and then it would be the L. Well, yes, and then it took some 15 to 20 years, and that's the measurement. Nowadays, there are better methods even than this. And the match is pretty impressive, which I think is a pretty good argument that we should take inflation seriously. Of course, people are trying to go beyond inflation, but and one should do this. But at the moment, it's pretty much the only game in town.
Well, this is the subject of the course that I teach next term. How is it that quantum fluctuations, which we normally think of as being very small, could seed structure in the universe on the size of, you know, billions of light years? And the amazing phenomenon is that if you do quantum field theory on an expanding space-time, that quantum fluctuations that are normally very small can actually be stretched out to very, very large scales and indeed seed the fluctuations. So that really, you start off with some quantum fluctuations which then get amplified and expanded in size, and then they would be leading to an inhomogeneous energy distribution in the universe, or curvature fluctuations. And they would lead to the fact that the hydrogen gas would preferentially condense in some regions and preferentially not condense in other regions, and that would lead to the formation of the first galaxies and so on. Well, in short, if the theory is right, we are quantum fluctuations. This all structure would be used.
And so when you were discussing the problem where how two photons could look similar, in what way were they similar? I mean,
to what? If you just postpone it because we're a little bit late, we can always talk after the class. Okay, and how does this calculation go? Well, very roughly, the early history of inhomogeneities is well described in the linear approximation. What I said in the previous slide, I was just going over that very quickly. Once fluctuations are strong enough, they become nonlinear, just like water waves. When they are big enough, become nonlinear, and you get breaking waves and all sorts of things that are not described by sine and cosine. But if water waves are small enough in amplitude, then they're described by linear equation. And similarly here, in the case of the universe, where initially there were just very, very, very small fluctuations, but they were enough to lead to preferential accumulation of hydrogen in one region and not in another region. And that went on for many, many years until the overdensities were so strong that the so-called gain instability was reached, nonlinear phenomenon, and condensation of the hydrogen atom happened fast. Hydrogen atom happened faster than the expansion of the universe would than the speed with which the expansion of the universe would drive hydrogen atoms apart. So then you really get the condensation of the galaxy. You see, hydrogen atoms in principle want to grow apart from another because they are neutral and they just follow geodesic motion with the flow of the expansion of the universe. But if the overdensity, underdensities are strong enough, then you get condensation and decoupling from the overall flow of the expansion of the universe. And so you have a galaxy. I mean, for example, a galaxy is not expanding. The distance between, I mean, the space between two galaxies is expanding, but the galaxy itself is not expanding because it's in a bound state. But long before that happens, we still have a linear behavior, and we can do linear perturbation theory of the shape of space-time and Linear's perturbation theory of the inflaton field phi. So we look at the Einstein action. We look at the action of a scalar field, of an inflaton field. And then one introduces some convenient variables here, namely co-moving positions, co-moving time variables. This is called the conformal time variable because the metric then gets rid of the A scale factor. And then we allow the field phi and as well the metric also to fluctuate. For the purpose of this course, I can only describe this as a classical fluctuation, but of course in the course that I teach next term, we will study exactly how those things are quantum have quantum fluctuations. So the field phi, being a quantum field, of course, will have fluctuations. But also the metric has quantum fluctuations. And the metric can be written as being contained, as consisting of three parts, one part that is called scalar, one part that is called vector, one part that is called tensor. Now you might think that's nuts, because the metric is always a tensor, right? It's always a two tensor. So how come it is a scalar, vector, and tensor part? Well, it's a decomposition that is completely analogous to the decomposition of a vector field. Any vector field can be decomposed into a gradient field and a curl field, right? You know it from electrodynamics. Okay, what does that mean? It means that the vector field is decomposed into a gradient field, which is completely determined by a scalar function plus the curl, okay? And the gradient part of the vector field is therefore called its scalar part, because it's described simply by a scalar function, right? And similarly, the metric can be decomposed into something that's just the derivative of a scalar function, or several scalar functions, plus something that's the derivative of vector value stuff, plus the rest that they cannot be decomposed, would be just like the curl part of the vector field. This is the complicated decomposition of this. And one does this decomposition because those guys evolve separately in the linear approximation, the scalar part, the vector part, the tensor part. And it turns out that fluctuations in the scalar part do get amplified and stretched out in an inflationary epoch. The vector and tensor parts don't. And, well, the tensor parts as well, but not as much. And the vector parts not at all. But in any case, it's useful to consider them separately. The scalar part is derivatives of scalar functions, the vector part is derivatives of vector functions, and the tensor part is tensor.
And then we can calculate, for example, the scalar and the tensor perturbation. And one introduces this variable here, which is the intrinsic curvature, but I suppose we don't have time to go really into this. Well, in short, what I want to say is that one looks at the scalar fluctuations, and the scalar fluctuations combine the scalar fluctuations of the scalar field and the scalar fluctuations of the metric combine into one set of fluctuations. You see, the inflaton field is coupled to the metric through the Einstein equation. So what one field does, the other one has to do as well, roughly speaking, because they're coupled. So if there's a fluctuation in the metric, the inflaton field will notice. And if there is a fluctuation in the inflaton field, the metric will notice, but only the scalar part of the metric. So the scalar part of the metric and inflaton field form a team. They fluctuate together. And the overall fluctuation is given by this expression here, which is also called the intrinsic curvature. And then there are vector fluctuations, which are usually neglected because it turns out that they are not getting amplified. The tensor fluctuations are being considered. And the point is that experimentally, the scalar fluctuations are dominant. They are describing with very good approximation the spectrum of the temperature fluctuations in the cosmological background. The tensor fluctuations contribute a little bit to this, but not measurably so, not distinctly so. But they do contribute to the polarization spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. And that is something that is high priority research now, because if those tensor fluctuations induced fluctuations in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background were measured, it would be the equivalent of hitting a jackpot, because those tensor fluctuations, remember what they are, they come from fluctuations of the metric. Okay, there's no scalar field involved in them. Only the scalar part of the metric combines with the scalar field to form this variable here, which describes the fluctuation. And they account for the bulk of the fluctuations in the temperature of the CMB. But then the tensor part of the metric fluctuates on its own, and it causes fluctuations in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, a particular kind, and I will tell you in a moment what kind. But it produces fluctuations in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. And if that was measured, it would mean the jackpot, because we are measuring then fluctuations of the tensor part of the metric. And the tensor part of the metric, one can show, corresponds to Weyl curvature. And the Weyl curvature, if you remember, is gravitational waves. So first of all, it would be a jackpot because we measured gravitational waves, because that's what they are. And secondly, we would be measuring quantized gravitational waves. We would be measuring the quantum fluctuations of gravitational waves, really. And that means we would measure an effect of quantum gravity. So therefore, it is of highest interest to try to measure the polarization spectrum of the cosmic microwave background to sufficient precision to find out where the tensor fluctuations are in. Now, fortunately, the tensor fluctuations have a special signature in the cosmic microwave background polarization. The polarization spectrum of the cosmic microwave background you can view as a vector field. At every point in the sky, the polarization points in some direction, okay, and you can view that direction as a vector field in the sky, which you can decompose into a curl and into a gradient part. The curl part of it is what is caused by the tensor fluctuations. So this is the jackpot. Measure the curl part of the tensor fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. This is one of the things that the recently launched, it was launched this year, the Planck satellite is setting out to measure. It's mostly measuring just the temperature fluctuations, but it's also measuring the polarization, and there is a small chance that it might pick up a curled part of the polarization spectrum, in which case it would be a really big deal. then how to take the kind of fluctuations. Whew, I'm really feeling bad and drank in such a late time here. Well, you see, basically what you do for that purpose is you expand the action of the interaction field and the Einstein action to second order in the curvature and in the this R was this scalar fluctuation and the H, the tensor fluctuation. You expand that to second order, and once it is in second order, it is basically a free quantum field theory without any interaction term. And that is something whose quantization we know how to do, at least after we've taken the course next year. And then we can calculate exactly what the spectrum is. Right. Quite a few people, and let me just end with that comment, quite a few people have horses riding in this race. You see, if those tensor fluctuations could be measured, we would be measuring gravitational waves. In fact, the quantum fluctuations of the gravitational waves that are quantum fluctuations of gravity, and they could tell us in principle a lot about this early inflationary period. But the early inflationary period happened so close to the Big Bang that it could have been influenced by Planck scale physics, by quantum gravity. So therefore, the ultimate hope is not just to find confirmation of the prediction when we measure one day those tensor fluctuations in the polarization, but some deviation from the usual framework. Because those deviations would tell us about how quantum gravity works. It would tell us how we have to deviate from quantum field theory, how we have to deviate from general relativity to account for whatever those tensor fluctuations are doing. So if the tensor fluctuations are behaving roughly like the ordinary theory of general relativity and quantum field theory predict, but not quite exactly, that would be the best case scenario. Because it would mean we are not completely off, but we can still learn new stuff. That would be just fascinating. In any case, so next term I will teach a course on quantum field theory for cosmology. Same technology with the tablet PC and also in this room, only that next term it will be Tuesdays and Thursdays from 4 rather than Mondays and Thursdays. And also I hope not to have to double up sessions. So in any case, if some of you already are quite sure that they are interested in this, you can let me know. I already have a few, no, not already. I still have some printouts of lecture notes of last time. So, you know, the booklet of the copy is not that much, right? But it's also online already. Right. So this is the homepage of the course. All right, so we are through. Okay, any questions? Just a second. I mean, who is it who is watching there in, is it at McMaster or in Guelph? Where are you, please? This is McMaster, right? Okay, I can see you nodding, right. Are you Andrew? Are you Andrew? I can't hear you. Please nod or shake your head. Now I can't see you. Please move to your left. Please move to your left, then I can see you. Right, now, are you Andrew or not? I can't hear you. Please shake your head or nod. No, you're not Andrew. Okay, I got it. Now, so the thing is this. Are you taking the course for credit? If you do, you'll have to figure out something about the final. Can you send me an email if you take the course for credit? Then we'll figure out something about the final, okay? Please just send me an email at some point. Okay, thanks. All right, great. Yeah.